story starts on the west coast of the United States in Coronado, California, which is known as sort of the birthplace of naval aviation. And also on this peninsula of Coronado, there are all the wives and families of the pilots that live there. Sybil Stockdale is really the center of the story. She is married to Jim Stockdale, who is a fighter pilot. And Jim is shot down during the Vietnam Wars, and he's shot down in 1965, and he becomes a prisoner of war. Sybil, back on the West Coast in Coronado, is told by the government to keep quiet. She's not allowed to talk about her husband's prisoner of war situation with anyone except for her immediate family. Many, many people on the West Coast are in her situation, many military wives. Also those on the East Coast, like Jane Denton, who is Jeremiah Denton, another very famous prisoner of war. Jerry and Jane are based out of Virginia Beach on the East Coast. Jerry is also shot down and ends up in the Hanoi Hilton with Jim Stockdale. And soon, Jane Denton on the East Coast and Sybil Stockdale on the West Coast find each other and work with many other wives to form an advocacy group for these men and to really fight the government who's telling them all to keep quiet and not talk about their situation. They realize very quickly this is not viable, and within a couple of years are going public without the government's permission, talking about their husband's situation, and they eventually force the government to listen to them and to take some action to get their husbands out and also to account for the missing servicemen that have been shot down in Vietnam.
Heath Hartage Lee, in the book The League of Wives, you also touch on some of the tactics these wives used to influence and get the government to actually take action. Can you highlight a few of those tactics?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they had many, many very clever tactics. And at first, as I was saying earlier, you know, they had to keep quiet. They kept on the down low. They kind of organized in their own communities. And that was just sort of getting them ready for what was to come. But later, when the first thing they all do, led by Sybil Stockdale, is to go public in the press. She's the first to go public in 1968 in the San Diego Union paper, where she just begins talking about the fact that her husband's a prisoner and the North Vietnamese are not following the Geneva Convention. And that just unplugs everybody across the country, then starts going to the media. The media is the biggest ally of these women in terms of getting the word out about what is actually going on. They don't start talking about the torture in the press until 69, but in 68, the dam is starting to break, and then it becomes a flood of other wives coming forward. Another tactic that they use very successfully, and they ally with Ross Perot, who's just died very recently, the eccentric Texas billionaire. At that time, Ross Perot was a Naval Academy graduate, and so he was very tied into this POW MIA advocacy effort for that and other reasons. So he lends all his money, planes, time, all these things to fly a lot of these women over to Europe, to Paris, to confront the North Vietnamese at their consulate there in Paris. And then some of the ladies go on their own later to Sweden and fan out across Europe, confronting the North Vietnamese at their various consulates. And this, they go on the pretense that they're going to find out information about their husbands. They quickly realize the North Vietnamese are going to give them nothing in terms of that information. So it's worthless from that point of view. But where it is very worthwhile is the bad publicity they generate, again, in the international media about the North Vietnamese and about how cruel and inhumane they are, that they won't even tell these wives what's going on with their husbands. So that is a very good tactic. And then the other thing they do from the beginning of this problem, this issue that they deal with missing husbands, is to go to Washington all the time, to walk the halls of Congress and basically stalk senators from their states and any politician from their state they can grab to inform them about the POW MIA situation. Because as Senator Bob Dole, who was a big champion of these women, told me, when he came to Congress, and he had been there for a while, but he is speaking of about by 1969, he said everyone in Congress, they still didn't know what a POW or an MIA, a prisoner of war, a missing in action serviceman was. Even at that point in the war, which is about midway through, people didn't know. So a lot of what the women did was just simply awareness building. And there were all kinds of other tactics. They used petitions, letters, et cetera, both domestically and internationally, but they all came together in such a great way, as well as the POW bracelets, which people still remember that were for fundraising purposes to support the women's activities. But they did a lot more than that in terms of brand awareness of the POW MIA problem.
Do you think if these women hadn't banded together and in a way stepped out of their prescribed roles as military wives, that the government would have delayed even further on taking action on bringing POWs home?
Absolutely. There is no question. I spent 5 years researching this, interviewing people, all the women involved who are the most important figures, but also political figures. John McCain, I interviewed for this book, Henry Kissinger, lots of those from the Nixon and Johnson administrations about what had happened. And there was just no doubt in my mind that one of the biggest reasons that the torture eventually stopped in 1969 was due to the efforts of these women publicly talking about this horrible treatment and shaming the North Vietnamese into some kind of compliance. In 2016, I was able to interview John McCain about these women, like Sybil and Jane, and their role in the prisoner of war treatment. And he said that without the advocacy of these women, without them bonding together as a group and becoming a legitimate entity, a real entity, that many more men would have died from maltreatment. The torture in 1969, in large part due to the women's efforts, completely stopped. McCain said it was like a light switch going on. It was clearly a decision that had been made by the North Vietnamese communists that this was to stop because the women had gone to the press.
I can imagine as a military wife in that time, it was hard for them to see themselves this way, at least at first. And this kind of advocacy and challenging of authority that they lived under and even championed must have been quite a challenge for them and probably changed them quite a bit. Is that something that you encountered as you were looking at this story and talking to these women?
Oh, absolutely. You've hit on one of the major issues for these women right off the bat, which is they were very rule-based, rule-conscious, protocol-following conservative military wives. And there's a book that kind of epitomizes that approach. There's not just one, actually. There are all these military wife guides, the Navy wife, the Army wife, the Marine wife, the Air Force wife, that basically told women to stay in their place, follow the rules. And if you did not follow this government military protocol, you could ruin your husband's career. You could end it by not towing the line. So they had that deeply embedded in their psyches. These are women, both in their 40s, the older wives like Sybil and Jane, and then younger wives that I talk about in the book, like Phyllis Galanti and Andrea Rander, who are in their 20s and 30s. But they've all been indoctrinated with these Navy wife type protocol manuals. So to step out of line, to defy the military, to defy the government, knowing you could ruin your husband's career was super scary. And so courageous and brave, because that was really the least of the stakes. I mean, they were mostly just worried about their husbands being alive and coming home alive in one piece. And that really outweighed, I think, the concerns about career and protocol at a certain point. It took a couple of years for these women to fully come out and go public with this. But I know Jane Denton particularly, I mean, they worried themselves sick about whether this was the right or the wrong call, but they all eventually decide that the benefits of going public outweigh keeping quiet. And indeed, they turn out to save lives that way. That is the right call. McCain also said, yes, that was the right call. That's what we needed someone to do to fix this situation.
I'm curious how you found this story. I know it's out there, it's part of history, but it's not one I know well. So I'm curious, when did you uncover that there was a there? Something to write about.
I like that. There was a there. That's exactly right. This is not a story I had ever heard of. I did not know about it. I'm 49, so I don't even remember the Vietnam War from my perspective. But I found this, as I find most of my stories, in a very sexy place, museum archives, which actually are pretty amazing, awesome places. Found this in the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, which at that time was known as Virginia Historical Society. I started working on this story in 2015, and the staff there called my attention to some papers, the papers of Phyllis Eason Galanti, who was a Richmonder like I am, from Richmond, Virginia. She had lived there for many years. Her papers she had given to the museum. She actually was a good friend of my mother's, so I knew her story that she had been a big POW MIA activist, but I didn't know much more than that. And the staff there knew I was looking for sort of hidden histories of women. I've always been in that space my entire, 20 plus year career, either as a curator or a biographer. So they invited me to come look. And within 2 hours of looking at her papers, I was like, oh my God, this is an epic story about Vietnam that we've never heard of. I had never heard of any of these women. I did not know what the National League of Families, that these women sound as the advocacy group. I'd never heard of it. And Phyllis's papers gave me almost a roadmap of who to talk to, how the movement started, her personal battle with that to bring her husband Paul back, who had been shot down in 1966. So it started with an archive. It started with, a bunch of old newspaper articles, diaries, letters, and that's usually how I end up finding my story.
Well, Heath Hartage Lee, author of The League of Wives, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
You are welcome. Thank you for having me.